From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tipper Gore championed mental health coverage when her husband was in office. Now the buzz is that compassionate conservative George W. Bush is set to do the same. In this hour, revisiting the mental health care debate, does removing the stigma of mental illness first mean paying for treatment? We begin with the meeting of Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia and President Bush in Crawford, Texas. Bush came out of today's meeting calling again for Israel to withdraw from Palestinian areas and asserting that Saudi Arabia would not cut off oil supplies to the U.S. But tensions between the two old allies run high. Yusuf Ibrahim is a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations and recently returned from the Middle East. Earlier, I asked him how he interpreted the signals coming from Texas.
I would say ominous. The relationship is fraying. It's not quite a divorce yet, but I think the Saudis, as we did before, indeed, since September 11, are serving notice upon each other that we have requests of them, and this is in a very forceful way the first time they have said they also have requests, and added to this that for the first time in a long time, they have something called an oil weapon.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by that?
I think Saudi Arabia in this relationship basically seems to feel it's been taken for granted by the United States. And another development that it's very, very important to take into account here is that the Arab satellite revolution, which has brought for the past 2 months images of what's happening in the occupied territories.
This is satellite TV, Al Jazeera, and it's
not only Al Jazeera. Mm-hmm. Al Jazeera has infected all the at least the other five major Arab satellite stations, which are doing the same thing. I was just there. I was just in Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. in the Gulf for 3 weeks. The coverage is simply overwhelming in terms of showing the Israelis and the Palestinians and what's going on. And it is, of course, very emotionally disturbing for many Arabs. So what is happening to Saudi Arabia and indeed what is happening to Egypt and to all our important allies in the region, including Morocco and Jordan, is that they have a public now which is demanding action. And the action is to ask the United States to put pressure on Israel. Now, the Crown Prince has launched his initiative, which was promptly buried by the latest developments in the incursions.
This is the so-called Saudi peace plan.
Correct. First it was a suicide bombing, and then the incursions and the invasion of the West Bank, and that has simply buried the Saudi initiative. But the president has said and asked Israel to withdraw immediately, and then he said, I mean by immediately now, and nothing has happened. And I think the Saudis turned this visit into a very blunt speaking session in which Abdullah said to Bush, and Bush is equally blunt, that we really expect you to put pressure and stop Israel, that I would like at a minimum to leave with a pledge that Israel will get out of the West Bank.
Yusuf Ibrahim, you covered this region for almost 20 years. You know it so well. Is a divorce possible between the United States and Saudi Arabia?
It would be a great shame because we have great national interests to preserve in Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis have every interest to remain our ally.
But is it even a practical possibility? Could these two nations disentangle their affairs and part ways?
I think it may be inevitable rather than a possibility. Yes, they could. It will take a long time, and it will be a serious error because what you untangle, you cannot put back together. For example, if we were to pull out our military from Saudi Arabia,
yes,
or if they were to ask us to leave, it would be quite impossible to come back.
To get back. Mm.
And the further damage to this is that it will withdraw the cover that is giving other countries in the region like Qatar, Kuwait, mm-hmm. and Oman to have troops. I think it's naive to assume that if the Saudis said get out, our military can simply move to a place like Kuwait or Qatar. I think we have to see this in the context of the Gulf Cooperation Council, and this is, after all, Saudi Arabia is the godfather of the Gulf.
All the way around the
region.
What would the implications for Saudi Arabia be if they saw a real significant cooling of relationship with the U.S.?
Well, of course, they do look upon this relationship as a strategic one. It's been 60 years. They consider themselves very reliable suppliers of oil to the United States. kids, and they look upon us to some extent as their protectors. They remember very well 1990 and how the United States came to their rescue.
If they give up that protection, who can they turn to?
Well, they do have now, the situation has changed in the region, and there is a measure of regional stability. Much of it has to do with Abdullah. Abdullah has worked things out with Iran, and they are prepared to work things out with Iraq as well. So they don't feel at this point an immediate threat from their neighbors, but they would not like to see the United States depart just the same.
Do you see the Palestinian issue having taken over this meeting in Crawford, Texas? Is there room for anything else on the agenda?
Totally. Absolutely. I think what Abdullah is telling Bush is not only that this is the most important issue, but that you can't even begin to think about Iraq. I mean, probably all these regimes in the region would like to see Saddam Hussein go. But what Abdullah is telling Bush is we can't even begin to think about this before we address the Palestinian issue.
What does Abdullah need to take away from Texas to feel that he's achieved at least minimally satisfactory meeting with President Bush?
Well, the president did ask, and our Secretary of State did say that Israeli forces should stop their incursion in the West Bank and get out of there. And eventually that we should move fast, not slowly, towards the establishment of two independent states there, a Palestinian state, and the word was pronounced. I think what the Saudis would like to see is some practical steps in that direction.
But your byword tonight, Yusuf Ibrahim, is ominous.
I think ominous, and we are really flirting with divorce.
Yusuf Ibrahim is a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. Next Monday, President Bush is reportedly planning to strongly endorse legislation that will force employers to expand insurance coverage for psychiatric illness. Many mental health professionals support the legislation, which would cover more than 200 mental health disorders, including anorexia, sexual disorders, and depression. But business groups and some GOP lawmakers say that a sweeping mandate for mental health coverage will bankrupt employers and small businesses. Should mental health patients get the same coverage as patients with physical problems? Is it time to extend equal insurance coverage to anorexia and agoraphobia? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Andrew Sperling, Director of Legislative Affairs for the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Sperling.
How are you?
Real well, thank you. Also with us from New Hampshire Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Good evening, and hello, Jack. Are you there, Jack? I'm sure Jack will join us shortly. Andrew Sperling, bring us up to date. There were stories today in the Washington Post and elsewhere saying that President Bush is expected to endorse this parity in coverage for mental health insurance next Monday. We don't know exactly if that will happen, but tell us, what is the legislation that's being talked about, and where does it stand? What would it do, and where does it stand?
The legislation is known by the shorthand term of parity, and it's a very simple requirement. It simply states that health plans ought to and should cover treatment for mental illness on the same terms and conditions as all other illnesses. And it's based on really some advances we've made in, our nation has made in science and treatment over the last decade or so for major mental illnesses, particularly schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression.
You mean advances in treatment?
And science as well. It is understanding what effective treatments are, what causes these illnesses, and what effective interventions are, and has led to the conclusion that NAMI has reached long ago that these are real illnesses, that treatment works if you can get it, and that there's no scientific or medical justification for a health plan to cover these illnesses on different terms and conditions.
Andrew Sperling, many of us may not be familiar with exactly the gap in coverage that exists right now. How similar or different is the coverage that's typically extended to mental health coverage from other kinds of medical treatment?
Health plans today are allowed to impose treatment limitations, whether it be on outpatient visits or inpatient days, or on copayments, like, for example, for filling a prescription, that there might be, a $30 or $40 copayment for an antipsychotic medication and a $10 copayment, say, for a high blood pressure blood pressure medication or any other medication for a medical condition.
So that's an unpleasant kind of a gap, but how serious is it really if someone runs into mental health problems? Are they accustomed to the kind of insurance coverage they've had for a broken leg or a ruptured spleen? How shocked are they going to be by the kind of bills that show up to cover mental health problems?
Very shocked. A single hospitalization can wipe out an entire health insurance policy relative to coverage for psychiatric illness. And the result is that taxpayers end up holding the bag because people exhaust their private health insurance coverage and they're forced to rely on public sector programs like Medicaid and Medicare at tremendous expense to the taxpayers.
Give us some more examples of the kind of mental health maladies that we're talking about seeing covered here.
Well, the Senate bill, the current bill that was drafted by Senator Domenici and Senator Wellstone, would require health plans to offer parity coverage for all of the diagnoses in what's called the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of the APA. And those include a range of illnesses from the more severe to the less severe. But the legislation also has provisions that would allow health plans to manage benefits so they wouldn't have to have parity level coverage for treatment that isn't deemed medically necessary or that is outside of a treatment plan or outside of existing clinical treatment guidelines.
Mm-hmm. Where does that legislation stand right now? This is a legislation that Domenici and Wellstone have worked on for a long time.
That's exactly correct. They've been working on this legislation for nearly a decade now. The bill has passed the Senate in various forms at least four times since 1996, and most recently was reported by the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, chaired by your own Senator Kennedy, back in August of last year.
Who's opposing the bill then?
The bill is opposed largely by business organizations and by some of their allies in the House Republican leadership.
Because of cost?
Exactly. And NAMI believes that those concerns over costs are not well-founded. We, in fact, have numerous studies demonstrating that a parity requirement results in only marginal increase in health care costs. The Congressional Budget Office has assessed the impact of the Senate bill, and they believe that it would only increase health insurance premiums 0.9%, less than 1%.
Mm-hmm. And what's the latest that you've heard on whether, in fact, President Bush is going to come out and do this? We saw this very strong report in the Washington Post this morning. Then later today, Senator Domenici's office put out a statement saying no agreement has been reached on substance or procedure yet. Is the president hovering over this thing? What are the pressures on him?
I imagine the pressures are quite severe, but I don't think that's so much the issue. I don't think it was ever in the offing that the president was going to endorse any specific legislative proposal next week. I think the issue is whether he's going to make a public declaration of support for equitable coverage for mental illness treatment in principle, and then pledge to work with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle to try and resolve this issue.
Andrew, give us a sense of a typical family or person who might run into one of these problems and what it would mean financially to them if this bill is passed or if it's not passed.
Let me give you an example of what I would view as a typical NAMI family. It is a middle-class working family who has a child in late adolescence or early adulthood who has onset of either bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, and within a matter of months can exhaust their coverage with either one or two hospitalizations, and they're simply left with no coverage at all.
And then what happens?
They're often forced into very tragic circumstances where their child essentially needs to seek services from the public sector system.
Is that a tragedy?
It certainly is, because in order to qualify for example, for a program such as Medicaid in this country, you have to get poor and stay poor.
It's a pretty high price to pay.
Yeah, it is. You have to meet certain eligibility and income standards. You have to be below all those thresholds to get on to Medicaid to get coverage for the treatment you need.
Andrew Sperling, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Andrew Sperling is Director of Legislative Affairs for the Nationally Alliance for the Mentally Ill. We're talking about parity for mental health insurance coverage. America's never had it. Is it time to give equal coverage to physical and mental health problems? Can the nation afford to fully insure treatment for bulimia, anorexia, depression? Can we afford not to insure for mental health? You can join us 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about parity for mental health insurance coverage. If the issue has never burst into your life, you may not know what it means to families or individuals who do run up against a mental health problem and then find that health insurance is far from covering the whole problem. Is it time to give equal coverage to physical and mental health problems? Can the nation afford to fully insure treatment for bulimia, anorexia, depression? Can we afford not to insure for mental health? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I think we're joined now by our esteemed news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, are you there?
Can you hear me from New Hampshire?
Loud and clear. Jack, we've been talking about this with Andrew Sperling in Washington, who's been following the legislation. But what do you see as the big issues buried here? Is this something that Americans have just been afraid to talk about or afraid that it would bankrupt the country to cover?
Well, you know, it keeps coming up. We came up in the Clinton administration, as you mentioned, with Tipper Gore, and there was a version of this passed early on, but it required high copayments that effectively discouraged people from exercising the insurance options that they had. But, you know, the latest Gallup poll shows that even with the war on terror, the public's overriding sense of the number one problem in the country is health care. 56% say that. 49% say the war on terror. So the president is clearly trying to speak to that and at this level, and the prescription drug benefit is another one, too. But this is an important way to address what is a kind of chronic. And you know, I think there's something even a cultural maturity here. I mean, I remember when Tom Eagleton couldn't even run for, you know, he had shock therapy, and that was thought to be some stigma that completely disqualified him for president. Of course, he didn't tell the truth about it either, but he didn't tell the truth because it was something shameful.
Are you so very sure, Jack, that wouldn't be a stigma in a presidential campaign today?
I don't know. I don't really know, but I just think that this is an important statement that the government would be getting, you know, that the Congress would be getting behind, saying this is like physical illness, folks, and the stigma attaching to it. It makes no more sense to stigmatize someone for depression than it does for having, say, diabetes.
And yet we have for a long time, and some people still fear the costs. And I guess that there's the whole issue of where you draw boundaries. I want to bring into our conversation Daryl Regeer. He's director of research at the American Psychiatric Association. He was research director at the National Institute of Mental Health for 25 years. Good evening and welcome, Daryl Regeer.
Thank you. I'm glad to join you.
Thanks for being with us. Give us a sense of how big a gap there is. Daryl, we heard a little bit from Andrew Sperling, but I'd like to hear it from you as well. How do you see the gap between insurance coverage for what most of us think of as physical health problems and mental health problems?
Well, I'll give you the example that was found in the Federal Employees Health Benefit. Before they adopted, the Office of Personnel Management adopted a parity mental health benefit that went into effect last year in January of 2001. The copayments for one day of hospitalization in an out-of-network hospital were $400 per day. For an in-network hospital, they were $250 per day for an inpatient hospitalization. In contrast, we're talking about literally $10 or $20 per day for somebody who would go in for a medical or surgical condition. So, in terms of copayments for outpatient care, the typical copayment would be 20% for an outpatient visit for a medical surgical condition, and double that, or 40%, for a person who went in for an outpatient medication management or some type of outpatient psychotherapy.
So we hear the percentages and the absolute dollar amounts, but what does it add up to in the course of treatment? Give us some examples of different kinds of mental health problems and what the treatment might cost an average American if they had to face that kind of gap.
Well, as Andrew said earlier, the problem is that when you have these kinds of insurance coverage caps, you have a tremendous disincentive for people to seek care within their insurance system. And because it literally can bankrupt a family if there is a severe mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
So you basically undercut the whole premise of insurance that you're trying to insure against catastrophic illness and of any kind, whether it's AIDS or, you know, some cancer or some other serious heart disease. Any of these conditions can bankrupt any family at any time, and that's the reason why insurance is so important. And the fact that a person who, by fate, happens to develop schizophrenia or bipolar disorder and have a serious hospitalization that can bankrupt them as opposed to a serious heart condition for which they are fully covered has come to be seen as really inequitable given the state-of-the-art of treatment. And it really represents a market failure on the part of the insurance industry that it isn't covering these conditions, which is the reason why government even bothers to step in.
Daryl Regeer, tick off some of the kinds of ailments we might be talking about here. And I guess start with the ones that would be at the center of this problem in terms of volume or severity, and then out toward the margins where conditions people might not think of that might require more insurance coverage than they get today.
Well, at the center of it is major depressive illness. Probably about 40 to 50% of all health insurance dollars for mental conditions are for major depression. And this is a condition that has just exploded in terms of our ability to treat it effectively with a whole new range of antidepressant medications. The serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, and so forth.
But we have the sense on that score that Prozac is everywhere, and people don't seem to have much trouble getting it or maybe paying for it. I'm not sure about that.
Well, I think the great benefit is that, in fact, many of these conditions are actually treated in primary care physicians, off the less severe ones, where they aren't really even given a diagnosis of a mental disorder, and they're given a prescription for an antidepressant.
So there's depression at the top of the list. Take us on through some of these.
Okay. I think then you would have something like the anxiety disorders that
such as?
May have generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder, agoraphobia,
fear of open spaces,
earlier, in which somebody is so confined to their house by anxiety that they literally cannot go outside the house without undergoing severe palpitations, fear that they're going to die, and it's a terribly socially incapacitating treatment disorder that is very amenable to treatment.
Give us some others.
Then you would go from the anxiety disorders probably to the more severe disorders like bipolar disorder or manic depressive illness. Again, the ability to maintain productivity in what otherwise is used to be a cause for lifelong institutionalization is literally amazing with the new mood stabilizers that have come out for these disorders. Schizophrenia remains the most daunting and most socially disabling condition because of the often long-term consequences of this. But again, some of the newer atypical neuroleptic medications like Clozaril, Olanzapine, Risperidone, and the like
and treat
enormous new potential for people who can actually live productive lives, certainly impaired compared to what they would have had without the disorder. But the wonderful thing that I found in my own patients, as well as in patients in our research studies, is that if you can catch these early, if you can catch them in the private insurance system, if you don't force families to basically abandon their children and put them in public institutions, you can actually keep these people at a functional level and enable them to contribute to society without even with the most severe disorders often becoming unproductive and dependent on the state.
Daryl Regeer, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Elizabeth is on the line. Welcome, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I just want to speak to this from a matter of both personal experience and also some business experience.
Okay.
The only reason that I survived as long as I did, I've had this, I was diagnosed at the age of about 16 and I'm 42.
Diagnosed with what, Elizabeth?
What?
Diagnosed with
bipolar disorder.
That's manic depressive?
Yes, mm-hmm. Manic depressive. Yeah, I think actually we should just call it that. But first thing I want to say is that it is a biochemical imbalance of the brain that, mm-hmm. and that is no different than diabetes, and it should never have been treated any differently from anybody's standpoint.
Did you have the insurance coverage you needed to deal with this, Elizabeth?
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about. The only reason that there were different times in my life where I had none when I left graduate school and mm-hmm. I just briefly fell out of my parents' Blue Cross Blue Shield program, the only reason that I survived was that I was hospitalized under the Hill-Burton Act at Jane Brown Hospital in Rhode Island under the care of Dr. Barry Fogle, and that was wonderful. I had the benefit of that while someone came into that hospital under, do you remember DRGs? I mean, this might be technical, but
it is technical, Elizabeth.
Diagnose-related groups, and she was allowed so much hospitalization based on her diagnosis.
And then shown the door.
And her children found her swinging from the chandelier. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the consequences can be pretty awful.
Because I was there under Hill-Burton Act, mm-hmm. And so parity is long overdue. It is something that I wished I had been able to get across with a very enlightened and progressive HR department, which did spousal equivalence mm-hmm. policy at Lotus Development, where I was for 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a member of MDDA Boston, and we did do a conference a while ago and brought in speakers. And there's a fellow who is the vice president of HR from First National Bank of Chicago.
Were they supporting it or opposing it? They've got parity.
They're 100% behind it. So some people are.
Elizabeth, I want to turn this over to Daryl Regeer, and I thank you for your call. Daryl, here's a story of someone who's dealt with bipolar for 25 years, sometimes had coverage and sometimes not. Is this typical?
It's absolutely typical, and it's a wonderful example, of real life on your call in there of what's happening in the community. The thing that I think you should know
mm-hmm.
is that actually the cost, the percentage of the overall health benefit attributable to mental disorders has dropped substantially over the last decade, from about 8% of the total premium to 2% between 88 and 97 for the federal employees' health benefit program.
Is this because of new drugs that make things treatable?
It was dropped because of the disincentives for because of these high co-payments, because of the disincentives for patients to use the benefit, and it was also because of the managed level of the benefit for access to services. So the old fear was that if you had parity, people would abuse the benefit and would use services they really didn't need. That was called the moral hazard argument.
Right.
The reality is now that with managed behavioral health care basically covering 90% of the insured population, they basically determine with your clinician whether or not the patient really needs this care. And they can monitor every 4 days whether or not you need to be in the hospital. They can monitor every 4, 5, or 10 visits whether or not you need to continue this care and what kind of treatment you have.
Mm-hmm.
And so what has happened is that the moral hazard now is not people will abuse care, but that they will be denied care by the managed behavioral health intermediary on behalf of the insurance industry.
Mm. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I want to bring in Kate Sullivan. Kate is Director of Healthcare Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Good evening and welcome, Kate Sullivan.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Kate, I know there have been strong concerns in the business community that this kind of parity coverage for mental health problems would bankrupt the country or at least some small businesses. What's the business view of this movement now?
Well, I wouldn't say that. At least we're not saying that this is going to bankrupt America or small businesses, but We put this in the larger context of what is happening with our health plan costs right now, and you really can't pick up a newspaper without, or turn on the TV without hearing that health plan costs are going up, and this is apart from parity laws or requirements to cover all kinds of medication, to cover a variety of benefits that I think any of us would really like to have in our health plans and fertility treatment and full access to all mm-hmm. kinds of wonderful preventive services.
But what you're concerned about is what it's going to cost companies to keep their employees covered.
I think what we're looking at here with the specific bill that's under consideration in the Congress is the way that it's written right now would really add a lot more cost to employer health plans, particularly plans that have been moving away from the managed care arena that Daryl had just described. One of the reasons why employers have been able to voluntarily expand access to mental health coverage over the last decade because they have recognized that doing so leads to more productive employees.
Mm-hmm.
There have been tremendous advances in the last 10 years over in terms of medication and understanding how to treat these conditions.
But Kate, Daryl Regeer was saying that their estimate is that this will only increase, and only, I know these are huge numbers, but would only increase the cost, if I understood it, 0.9% overall.
I'm glad you brought that up. That is an average cost that includes plans, employers who already fully comply with the law. So it includes zero impact. It does not break out what this means if you have a health plan that allows you to go to any doctor that you choose. The estimate there would be much higher. And the estimate also does not include, this is written in the report, it says they don't believe that they do not include the estimate of having to cover all conditions that are listed in the American Psychiatric Association.
So you think it could cost substantially more than that for many companies?
I think it's actually going to be significantly greater.
Such as on what scale?
Well, the government's own Department of Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration said it would cost an average of 3.4%.
Kate, we've just got another minute, but I'm sure that you don't represent people who are utterly heartless toward people who have bipolar or other serious mental health problems. We've heard tonight about how that can bankrupt families. What should be done here?
And we do have great sensitivity to this. I think it's just really it's a matter of talking to employers and saying, what is it that we can do to improve our health care benefits?
You either have parity or you don't, don't you?
Well, I think that there's much more that can be done within health plans on a voluntary basis. But the problem is you have those restrictions to manage this cost being taken away from employers. And at this point, apart from parity or whatever, they're just trying to keep up with their premiums. We have a real problem in this country about health care costs and employers being able to continue to afford the coverage.
But that sounds like we're sympathetic, but we just can't afford to help.
I think the employers would love to do everything we can, but we voluntarily provide these benefits now, and we are quickly seeing them get out of our grasp.
Mm-hmm. Kate Sullivan, Director of Healthcare Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We're talking about parity for mental health coverage. America's never had it, and if you've ever had a mental health problem, you know that. The costs are much higher than for other kinds of health coverage. The cost that the consumer is required to carry under most insurance programs. Is it time to give equal coverage to physical and mental health problems? Is parity in coverage of mental health way past due, or is it a Pandora's box? Why have we thought that a broken mind was less important than a broken leg? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about parity for mental health coverage. It may sound abstract, but if mental health problems come into your personal life or your family, you know how expensive, how devastating it can be. Is parity in coverage of mental health way past due, or is it a Pandora's box? And why have we thought that a broken mind was less important than a broken leg? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Rhea is on the line. Welcome, Rhea. You're on the air.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Real well, thanks.
Okay. I'd like to say that I have spent time in a mental institution.
Mm-hmm.
I've done it twice. Let me see. I think I've spent like a total of 7, maybe 8 months in one of those places.
Okay. So do you think we need better health insurance or not, Rhea?
I don't know. That's kind of too complex to give a yes or no answer to.
Okay.
But I will say that if you took what they did to me and you put it in a political context or a religious context, you would view that as a human rights violation.
What they did to you, the kind of treatment that you got?
I wasn't treated. I was jailed, and I was probably had what problems that I had, which I acknowledged when I went in there.
So how do you see it relating to the insurance question, Rhea?
Well, okay. I'm sorry, I've sort of gone off the point. I think that that a lot of these treatments, so-called treatments, end up treating people's problems as if in a sort of a dehumanizing way, and a way that involves, metaphors based on medicine. And when I say metaphors, I mean like when you say, treat a broken mind like a broken leg. When the mind doesn't exist, as a part of the body. The brain does, but the mind doesn't, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And it's to me, it's a social or a spiritual or emotional event which happens.
Rhea, we've got it. I want to put it to Daryl Regeer. Daryl, is there a sense in which Rhea sort of pointing to the ambiguity that lies around or is perceived by many people to lie around some kinds of mental illness? Can the society afford to treat that halo of ambiguity that sometimes surrounds these conditions?
Well, I think the criteria for mental disorders are increasingly being refined based on clinical trials of the effectiveness of medications and psychosocial treatments like cognitive behavior therapy and the like for very well specified mental disorders. The major advance of from say 20-30 years ago in the mental health area, and I don't know when your caller was hospitalized and like, but the major advance has been the increased specificity of the diagnoses and the increased specificity of the treatment. So there's not just one psychoanalysis for anything that ails you. There are very specific medications, there are very specific psychosocial treatments that have been subjected to highly rigorous clinical trials for mm-hmm. their outcome, mm-hmm. and it's based on a neuroscience base and increasingly increasing understanding of neurotransmitters, how they act in various areas of the brain. And,
so it's becoming a more exact science than you're saying. Jack Beatty, how about it? Do you, to the extent you've looked into it, do you see any fear engendered in society by the ambiguity of mental illness?
Well, I think what I heard in Rhea was a sort of rejection of the medical model. And I'm wondering mm-hmm. about that, Daryl Regeer. I mean, is there a kind of in medicalizing the problem, have we set up a kind of two-tier system? I mean, it does seem to me that psychopharmacology and managed care are really made for each other, but in a bad way. You go, your insurance will cover X number of visits. You go, they give you the pill, but you don't do the talking therapy that can deal with the underlying problem. So you get a kind of symptomatic management, but you don't deal with the underlying problem through insight therapy. Now, that's a big problem even with people who have insurance, and I'm not even sure this bill would affect that.
I guess we should ask Daryl Regeer, would the bill give full coverage to visits to the psychiatrist?
What they would do is they would give equal coverage to what is available for medical and surgical conditions. If the copayment is 10% for going for your strep throat, the copayment is 10% for going for your depression.
So if people are going to the therapist for 20 years, would that be covered?
Actually, I think that would be extraordinarily rare. In fact, what has happened with
Jack's talking about not the quick pill
right.
treatment, but the talking treatment.
Jack's assuming that the underlying condition is only some experience in the person's life as opposed to a biochemical imbalance in the person's brain. And I think the fact is that these experience and biochemical abnormalities in the brain are actually related. And we see this in post-traumatic stress disorder in which an extreme environmental impact can, in fact, produce biochemical changes in the brain, which isn't terribly surprising. And so what you have is the need to often treat somebody with the medications in order to, in fact, reduce those symptoms that make it impossible for them to even engage in psychotherapy. Mm-hmm.
Daryl Regier, we've just got a few seconds left. Do you expect that this is finally going to pass this year, or is it still just a big talking point?
We think it's very hopeful at this point in time. The president signed a parity bill in Texas for his constituents there. Senator Domenici, Senator Wellstone, Representative Rockema, and Representative Kennedy in the House all have worked tirelessly for this.
Mm-hmm.
We think that the fears about the costs are really decided by the Congressional Budget Office. The old statistics that
we'll know soon. Daryl Regier, we've got to cut out. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Daryl Regier is Director of Research at the American Psychiatric Association. You can read the current Mental Health Parity Act. It's on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. Jack Beatty, stand by. Coming up, Kofi Annan talks about the challenges facing the nations of Africa. This is On Point. Last night, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan delivered the annual Godkin Lecture at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Annan has presided over one of the most tumultuous periods in UN history. But in an era of international conflict and economic globalization, Annan, the first African UN Secretary General, spoke about Africa and the challenges the continent faces to realize its promise.
Africa has had a strained relationship with globalization. As a continent, it is less integrated into the global economy today than it was a decade ago. Insofar as it is largely through commodity exports, which works to the disadvantage of African countries as commodity prices have fallen steadily. Half of all Africans have never made or received a phone call. And less than 1% of Africans have ever logged on to the internet. Nowhere is it more important, therefore, to ensure the benefits of globalization are shared at every level of society. We are all tempted to talk and think of Africa in monolithic terms, and yet the reality is far more diverse and complex. There are immense differences among African countries in progress and political development, as well as social and economic reform. While some remain mired in ways of the past, many others are being transformed by new public demands and responsive political leadership. Increasingly, African societies are led by democratically elected leaders, accountable to their peoples, and guided by public interest. However, Africans, and not just outsiders, are beginning to say that for democracy to succeed in Africa, an electoral mandate alone is not enough. For elections to be genuinely free, and for the people to feel genuinely represented in government, much more is needed. Institutional checks and balances, an independent judiciary, viable political parties, a free press, and the freedom of each individual to express his or her ideas without fear of retribution. In Africa as elsewhere, we have learned from painful experience that authoritarian and highly personalized forms of government, ethnic discrimination, and violations of human rights have been root causes of conflict. Conversely, Africans, like others, have also learned that only democratic governance, by protecting minorities, encouraging political pluralism, and upholding the rule of law, can channel internal dissent peacefully and thus help break the cycle of conflict and poverty. What is encouraging about recent developments in Africa is that the pressure for good governance is no longer coming from one side or the other, but from peoples and leaders alike. The spirit of democratic empowerment is challenging all leaders to live up to the ideals of independence and to deliver the freedoms and the rights and opportunities their people deserve. My dear friends, it is clear from what I have described that in Africa today, challenge and opportunity are two sides of the same coin. Africans are more aware of this than ever before and are genuinely engaged in these issues on their own terms. First, they are addressing the conflicts in their midst by coming together as African leaders determined to solve their own problems. Second, Africans are confronting the scourge of HIV and are deeply conscious of the threat it poses to the very future of the continent. Third, Africans are developing new initiatives aimed at securing lasting development and economic integration. What is important about every one of these challenges facing Africa is that they are being met with African-led initiative, which emphasizes responsibility and ownership on the part of African leaders and citizens. The partnerships and programs that will succeed in responding to Africa's future and Africa's future needs must focus on helping Africans improve their own capacities and institutions. Supporting these efforts have never been more vital to the interest of the developed world and the international community. Let us together do all we can to help millions of people throughout Africa to improve their lives so that a continent so rich in human and natural resources can truly fulfill its promise.
That was UN Secretary General Kofi Annan delivering the annual Godkin Lecture at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Jack Beattie, high-flown language over a continent with a lot of really down and difficult problems.
Yeah, but hopeful withal. He seemed to be saying, well, they're facing up to problems, and there's a growing desire for democracy, and especially for the rule of law. You know, if you look at it historically, this may be a moment for Africa's reemergence. After the period of independence, the hopes were quickly dashed by dictatorships, post-colonial governments, and by Cold War meddling on the part of the Soviet Union and the United States, which afflicted these countries with terrible rulers. And now we have President Bush, of all people, saying, well, we're not going to give you aid money unless you straighten out your governance. Well, this is a new note from Washington, and maybe that kind of thing can actually help. We had someone on this show call up and say, don't give them another dime. They'll just steal it. He was talking about the Congo.
But I can't help, Jack, thinking about the recent elections that we've seen in Zimbabwe, the resistance in South Africa to treatment of HIV, even skepticism about the very existence of it as a threat.
I know, but apparently they're coming around rather fast on that. Sure, all these are huge problems, but we don't have, for the first time, really, well, I guess in 10 years, the grip of the Cold War just making Africans a pawn in the East-West struggle. Mm-hmm. And the death of Savimbi, I think, is sort of a symbol of that. You know, we sponsored this bandit for decades. Anyway, these people are starting to leave the stage, And let's hope that it's a better time for Africa.
Kofi Annan seems to see reason for hope. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.